It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Josh Brown, do you believe in aliens?
Oh, every week. This is why I love being on this podcast. You know what? Of course I do. I think you've got to believe in aliens, yeah. Even before the stuff this week came out. There's so many planets. The solar system's so big. We can't be the only life out there.
I don't know. There's some sort of amoebic life form out there having a hot take on whatever alien old nostalgic classic is being brought back.
Yeah, there's an old squid-looking boy with a lovely beard and a plaid shirt somewhere in the galaxy with a microphone in front of their face. And they're talking about, like, Squid Tekken 12 or something, you know.
Squid Tekken 3 was the best one. Welcome to the Entitled Partner Podcast, the UBP. I'm Scott Tilford. That's Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
Worth mentioning that Jules Gill is just a busy, busy man. I think going forward, man said he's probably going to be a guest every now and then, just whenever he frees up. So you never know what week he's going to appear on. You never know what you're going to get. Just like a box of chocolates.
I'm so sorry it's me again.
I'm not.
I'm sick of me, you know. So I'm very aware of overstaying my welcome. So I'm so sorry.
No.
And...
You can't overstay a welcome if the person keeps asking you to come back. Set up a permanent residence.
The people didn't ask me to come back, is what I'm trying to say.
The people's choice. But yes, the Entitled Banter Podcast is where we take everyone's questions, talking points, whatever's going on in the industry, and get through as many as we can. And we've managed about five or so.
Yeah, we
got more than through a couple. There's loads of good questions this week. Genuinely massive thank you to everybody for sending them in. So we'll get through as many as we can. First one from Willie Araya, who says, "Hey guys, since aliens are real, it seems, what is your favorite alien / extraterrestrial game? I don't really have one, but Guardians of the Galaxy was phenomenal." That is a good pick.
This question, right?
Yeah.
It's a great question, but I found it so weird because my instant thought was, well, there aren't that many games about aliens. Of course there are many games about aliens, but what's funny, in my opinion, is like what I think of as an alien is like a little green man with big eyes, not all of the aliens you see in a game like Mass Effect you know?
If you start thinking about games where you play as aliens, then it's only really, what was that one where you play as the little squid guy and you're underground and you're red? Carrion? That came out. There's that one. There's like Destroy All Humans where you play as the sort of alien 101. But yeah, Mass Effect would be the go-to.
I've seen Carrion before. I did not know that thing was an alien. I thought it was like a biohazard.
I guess you don't know.
Oh,
I guess
that right?
Could be spoilers. I don't know. But I guess, it looks very alien.
Yeah,
I
mean, it does. It's
very,
I'll give you it.
Test facility, it's broken out type thing. But yeah, thoughts on this whole alien business first before we go any further.
It's so funny. I've been really laughing at the tweets being like, you know, some person's like, hey, we've confirmed aliens exist. And everyone's just like, man, I got a lot on. You know, I got a lot on.
Not now.
Come on, not
why
now.
Why did you do this in the pandemic? Oh, even then, it probably would have been worse.
Yeah, that's the way I feel of it at the moment. I'm like, man, I'm trying to find some money to buy some bread.
It's like, what do you want me to do with this? I think for me, I'm kind of fascinated by it. One of my best friends used to be a huge believer and was always trying to convince us. And one time we were out in Tenerife, we were all have a few drinks in. We were just sat on a veranda and we were talking about alien stuff. And he's like, oh, there's all this evidence, all these different things. Tom DeLong believes it.
Well, yeah, right.
He has all these things. And I've never believed. I mean, I'm more atheistic. I'm agnostic anyway, but like in religious stuff. But like for aliens, I'm like, there's such a breadth of what you would classify as an alien. Like from a cellular amoebic life form.
Yes.
All the way through to what a lot of people assume, which is just a little man in pants riding a ship to the Earth. I mean, it's not going to be that. It's not going to be an actual crashed craft.
Wish it was. I think it's fascinating that you say there that you never believed. I think that's really, really interesting. Because I had a huge sort of space era when I was late teens, where I was like really into stargazing and like, staying up late for the asteroids to come past and like just kind of getting in over my head in like never an see existential sort of crisis kind of way.
I always liked the idea of that, but every time I got one of the telescopes, I could never see anything. No. It was always a bit blurry. It was always a bit, I just couldn't see it. And then I had the little star maps and I can't see any of it.
You needed to turn the big light off, mate. That's right. Change your brightness settings.
The only star is in the center of my ceiling.
I know what you mean. Like space as a concept is so huge in nature, it's hard to grasp any of it. I don't even pretend to grasp even 0.01% of it because it's so humongous. But the humongidity, I'm gonna make that word right now, is why I kind of have always thought, like, there's got to be something. There's got to be something out there. And it might not be the little green men that we were discussing earlier. They might not be coming down in cowboy hats or whatever. But, you know, something's got to be.
Blaster written. No, that's what I'm saying. I don't even think it's necessarily a question of belief. It's a question of classification. Like, there'll be something out there. That's why I mentioned amoebic stuff. Some sort of cellular gathering of chemicals that you could say is quote-unquote life. Like, I mean, plants are alive, but we're not talking to them.
Yes.
Like,
I mean, well, you're not. Mark Wahlberg is.
They're talking to me. But, it's one of those things where I don't doubt that there's something out there that just sort of looks like a puddle with a face, if it has a face. If it knows what a face is, that you could classify as an alien life form. But at the same time, it's just, it's not going to be anywhere near what people want it to be.
That's a good distinction, I think. Like, I don't think there's going to be, like we keep saying, you know, some face locked up somewhere behind bars.
Clawing at the glass slowly.
It is sort of a case of classification, like you said. I think it's fascinating as a lifelong Blink-182 fan to see Tom DeLonge so vindicated in all of this stuff.
I loved him tweeting the shades emoji. Just retweet the whistleblower with the shades emoji.
Like, as someone who had to endure the down period of Blink-182 because Tom DeLonge was so interested in his own company and doing this stuff with, like, the US government, I'm just pleased it was not for nothing, you know?
Yeah.
We lost a lot of music, but as long as he had an all right time and, you know, is now back in the news cycle being like, you all thought I was an idiot. And now look at this.
Look at this footage. Look at this footage I've got. I want to know more about it because so far we've had the whistleblower, the way that it was, he said, oh, there is like non-human entities. We can confirm that or whatever. That, like I said, that to me could just be some fancy oil from a different planet that landed here and you're classing that as non-human or whatever it is. So I want to see more about it. Favorite alien extraterrestrial games? I'm going Mass Effect.
That's got to be Mass Effect. Yeah. Absolutely Mass Effect. You know, we talked about this a few weeks ago, I think. No game for me has arrived with such a fully formed world, and a huge part of that was the different alien species that you could interact with and fight. The way they were designed, their political makeup, their cultural makeup, I thought was so fascinating. Mm-hmm. I think that's, like, to me, the peak alien game.
I'd take that. I think Mass Effect 1 the whole way as
well.
Absolutely. As I've aged, as I'm an old man, I prefer Mass Effect 1 now.
I had another one in mind there that I've completely forgotten about, which I know is really bad content, but like...
Call of Duty Infinite Warfare.
let's go with that.
Interstellar.
Space Invaders.
Space Duty.
I've been looking at it again.
Yes.
Right, before we move on. It's just hit the PlayStation Store a month ago. It was when I was going to buy Stay Out of the House, right? And I was just looking for something to play. Mm-hmm. I think it's called like... something like the Greyhound Incident. I know it's not Greyhound, but it's Grey something incident, right? And it is a kind of classic depiction of aliens with the big flying saucer and the big-eyed aliens, you know, arriving, and you've got like a little gun. It's got the worst reviews you've ever seen for a video game. And I want to play it.
Are you the alien? What happened to you? Why do you want to play the bad stuff?
Because the older I get, the more I like that classic depiction of
of
aliens.
Bad games.
Have you ever seen Alien Autopsy with Anton Deck?
No.
Really good.
I remember
movie.
When that... No, it's not. I remember when that was coming out and I was like, I can't... And everyone at the time when we were in school was like, oh, it's going to be great. No, it's not. It's not good. What are you doing?
Man, I think you should get that game and watch that movie and have a nice
weekend. I'm not going to do any of that. If there was an official Anton Deck video game... I mean, Anton Deck's a reference for the UK and the UK only, but if there was an Anton Deck action platformer, I'd be all about that.
Yeah.
Like an It Takes Two throwing each other across the platform.
I would enjoy that.
Exploring Biker Grove as a bonus level.
They're probably aliens anyway, so it would
They've
work.
Been here all along. Question from Josh Sloan, who says, as people that work in the games industry, do you ever wonder if your passion and interest in gaming would be higher if you were just a fan, unconnected with the industry?
Josh Sloan, I think about this all the time. I think about about it every
I think about
day.
It too, but there's a lot to this. I don't know. I don't think it would be higher if I was a fan. I'd be more oblivious to the realities of the things that bum me out about the industry. Yeah. But I don't think that would make me more of a fan. Like, I still love video games and love their... If anything, there's a greater appreciation for the industry overall. The thing that is tied to this is, at least what comes to mind for me, is how much we have to turn things over. Or we used to. Reviews used to be a bigger deal. We've never been a review-based business model, but there's that whole thing, the reality of reviews. You get given it like a few days before launch. Okay, get through this thing. Just get through it. And we always tried to make that work as comfortably as possible. But at the same time, there's something about relaxing that time frame and just playing it along with a community that is infinitely better. And I do think that the way that games coverage has changed over the years, you can just do that now.
Yeah.
And then we find ways to, you know, like, there's some incredible plot twist, scene, reveal, hero moment, whatever. We then do a list about that, and then you just talk about that in that list. And chances are more people have seen it anyway.
Absolutely.
So like, I'd like the way that the industry model for media has kind of changed to some degree. And obviously there are still review-based business models out there. But I don't think it hasn't changed how much I love everything. It's just hard to keep up with everything.
I would agree. You know, if you define fan by your interest in something, I definitely wouldn't be more interested or immersed if I wasn't doing this job. Mm-hmm. But if you define fan as someone who... I used to dream about video games.
Right.
Like, upcoming video games. I remember dreaming about GTA 5. I remember dreaming about Watch Dogs before it dropped. Mm-hmm. I don't do that anymore. I can't get that level of excitement because, like you said, you know, we now talk so much about the intricacies of the industry, all the bad parts, all the good parts. Mm. We usually know most of, like, the big trailer drops at a show like E3 before they happen.
Yeah,
of course,
sometimes.
Not all, but, you know, a good chunk of them are kind of... revealed beforehand, because these leaks always come out and a bunch of them are often really reliable. So you know about things so in advance. And I think that kind of impacts how you appreciate stuff, as does talking about the same games all the time, which has never been a problem for me, but I am kind of cognizant about, we do 3 podcasts a week.
Yeah.
You know, we do a bunch of lists, we do news, we do editorials. We're talking a lot
about
video games.
Yeah, we are living this coverage.
Living, we are breathing it, which is incredibly great in one sense, but I kind of do miss the times where I could just lose myself as a pure fan and kind of get swept up in the mystery and the magic of how video games are made, with that, not ignorance in mind, but that kind of like lack of intimate knowledge.
Yeah.
I love music, and I think part of the reason why I love music so much is because I know absolutely nothing
about it.
It's
just so funny, I was just going to say that.
Like, I don't know anything about music theory, I don't know anything about music production, I know the absolute bare basics of it.
Right.
And because of that, I find myself not necessarily thinking about how something was made and just kind of enjoying it for what it was without knowing any of the academia behind it. And it's not that I enjoy music more than games. It's just a different way of enjoying something that I've been like, that's just drawn more attention to itself as the years go on.
Yeah, man, massively. Music's an interesting one, because like, obviously, like, I love metal, heavy metal, rock. I mean, I love a lot of stuff, but heavy metal is my go-to thing, or thrash or metalcore, whatever. Once I learned how to play all those guitar solos, once I learned the construction of those elements, like now when I hear a guitar solo, 9 times out of 10, I know what they're doing. But at the same time, that does put a premium on newer bands like Polyphia, or watching people like Devin Townsend, or Tosin Abasi, or whatever, Tosin Abasi, things like that are just like, then it's like, oh my God, I don't know what he's doing, and that's incredible.
Right.
And I feel like that's kind of the thing that I'm chasing sometimes in the gaming industry. Like, that Viewfinder is like a phenomenal puzzle game now, and it's kind of gimmick, at least for the opening few levels, is 2D meets 3D. You're picking up pictures of things and you're placing them into a 3D world, but then when you move, you realize that that picture has become part of the 3D world, and that's kind of like, it kind of affects you on like a cerebral level, because space doesn't work like that.
Yes.
And that's so cool. And I feel like a lot of the wide-eyed, oh my God, gaming stuff came from when we were younger and we had no idea how any of it worked whatsoever, which, like I said, for me, I've only gained a greater appreciation for it. And if someone in the AAA space pulls off something like a Final Fantasy 16 or something, then that's unbelievable on a whole other level that I couldn't even comprehend when I was younger, because I had no comprehension of the coding techniques or the voice acting or whatever it was. So I think, like I said, it's a greater appreciation for it. I know what you mean about getting completely lost in something. And I think sometimes we kind of make a point. Sometimes you'll be like, I'm not going to watch any trailers for something. I still want to try and just go in fresh. And you managed to do that with Tears of the Kingdom. I can easily tap back into that just complete fan subjective side of me. I did it with Sonic. Like, I was just like, Sonic Frontiers, I'm looking forward to that so much. I can't wait for it.
Yeah.
And whatever. I'll throw in actually the question from Jack Jingle, who said, when was the last time you were on a genuine hype train or a notable one? Elden Ring was the last one for them. They still haven't played it and they likely never will, which is interesting. But yeah, I don't find it very... It's quite easy for me to slip into that
right,
mode. You
yeah.
just turn off the... I'm not going to follow every bit of this. Or I am, but it's going to be from a fan perspective. It depends how much is needed for the job, basically.
I will say, while sometimes I lament that side, the greater appreciation you were talking about there, I definitely absolutely love. Like, I think my... Since working in the industry, I guess you could say, like, my tastes have broadened so much more than what I used to have. You know, I'm playing games that I might not have touched, and I have a greater appreciation for them because I understand now the context that they're released in, the context that they're made in. You know, games like Immortality, games like Stay Out of the House, you know, those kind of titles that I might not have batted an eye at because I was so concerned about, you know, what's in the mainstream, what are people playing, what are people reviewing and talking about and whatnot. So it's definitely like there's pros and cons for each side, and I think if I was, you know, how I used to be, all fan without that intimate knowledge, I think I would, you know, still strive for a balance in between them. But unfortunately, I can't turn that sort of side of me on in the same way that you can.
My
even
thing
for
as well.
A game like, sorry, just no, no. Even for a game like The Last of Us Part Two, you know, which I absolutely loved and was looking forward to immensely, I couldn't quite get to the same level of hype that I had for Watch Dogs a few years prior
because
I was so aware of its construction. I was so aware of how long it had been in development, like the mechanics that we could bank on. I was almost more aware of its limitations, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the thing I was going to say was like that level of like you're following something so much, you're following the creators, the voice actors, the people that are putting it together. Obviously, in decades gone by, there was very little of that because we didn't have social media or whatever, but you would get magazine interviews. You would like there was, again, more curated, but you were still leading up to something. I was still approximating that level of intimacy with the industry before they paid me for it. So it was just, I kind of always had that anyway, but it was always like certain things are set aside as like mine. Like I know, for the most part, that no one's going to care about Sonic coverage.
Yes.
Like the Sonic fans will, but it's not like big enough for me to dedicate like a company's resources to it, even though I can force it in some places. But it's things like that. I think it's just sort of like, I've always liked that. It's always been the industry that I've loved. I'm always going to get involved with it. And then, like I said, for me, it's just a level of like appreciation for it.
That's it, to be fair. To sort of clarify, going to what you said at the start of that point there, like I was the same. Like I don't want to imply that I kind of knew nothing, started this job, and then suddenly got into it. Like it was, even if I didn't do this job or was in the industry at all, like my interest in how the construction of games was building to the point where it probably would have been around where I'm at now anyway. That was just a natural progression. The same way it worked for movies. Before I went to do a film degree, I had that interest and then that just naturally led to that degree. Like my interest in games led to this job because you just kind of get into that side of it. You kind of peel back the curtain and then you almost can't go back. It's just that for me, can't go back nature of it that sometimes I think, I wonder what it's like to have experienced The Last of Us Part Two without knowing so with knowing so little about the kind of specificities of the industry or the context in which it was made or leaks. Leaks is obviously such a big one. I think it's fascinating. I think that that question about like when you were or weren't on a hype train,
I was gonna say,
really
we should talk about
well.
The last time you were genuinely on a hype train, because I think to round off my side of the fan thing, the only thing, and I don't even necessarily lament it because we just don't do that many reviews anymore. There's a whole wider conversation as to how important reviews are in the industry anyway, hence the conversation around scores versus just like, you know, bigger, more editorial pieces or whatever. It is just the time frame thing. It's just like, obviously this year it's been absolutely rammed with games and we're lining them all up going like, well, I want to play 50 different things, and if I wasn't in the industry or I wasn't, you know, wanting to do podcasts and everything, obviously it's my own problem for doing this, I would just take my time. It wouldn't matter that I hadn't got back to something. I, you know, it wouldn't matter that I don't have an opinion on something. But at the same time, it's a privilege to do this for a living, so I try and keep up with everything as much as possible, as we all do. And so there is that sort of assumption that you'll keep up with all the named titles. And it's always funny when I talk to my brother-in-law and he's just getting round to something like Elden Ring, or he's just playing Resident Evil 2, and I'm just like, it's 2023, mate. You could have had that 5 years ago.
I think, you know, we sort of strike a nice balance because we're almost like on the periphery of the industry where, you know, we don't go to like the PR events. We're not like buddies with like developers or publishers.
We sometimes
or anything
have,
like that.
But
so we got contacts and stuff. But what I mean is like we don't have the same coverage-based model that other industries that are well integrated in the industry do, where like, you know, and I'm not saying that's bad by anything. I would love to be flown out to Naughty Dog Studios and talk to Neil Druckmann. Of course I would.
Give me the Tekken 8 stream code right now.
But because we're on the periphery, I think we can kind of straddle the line between like fans and people. I don't even know if I would class myself as in the industry. We talk about it.
I think we definitely are, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, like it's just kind of like, It's on a weird line, I find, yeah, there with us.
I quite like that because, yeah, we get a lot of opportunities to attend stuff. 9 times out of 10, we just can't afford to get there. Like, it'll be in different countries or it'll be down in London. A lot of people think we're down in London anyway. So it's very pick and choose for things like that. But we have been able to do hands-on stuff like Final Fantasy VII or Sekiro or go to EGX or whatever it is. But it's always on our terms. Like, we don't need to be there, like, which is the beauty or the double-edged sword or whatever of having a list-based YouTube channel. Like, it does free everything up, but it means you're then trying to make everything fit into a list model, or the majority of it anyway. But yeah, I, for the most part, like, I think it works. Like, I think that's it frees up the need to crunch something. And obviously, like, yeah, the review conversation is a different thing, or the need to get through everything is a different thing.
Yeah.
But we always find ways to make it work when it's relevant. Like, you've just done an incredible editorial. I don't know if it's spoilers to say what it's on.
Go on, see.
But that's a whole thing on Stay Out of the House and, like, one of the most overlooked games of the year, which we didn't do back when it very first launched, even though it is quite recent. There wasn't a need to absolutely crunch it and turn it around and get it out on the launch day weekend or whatever, because we can make it work elsewhere.
That's it. I think there's been, like, a very good conversation happening over the past few years around that turnaround, and I'm so pleased we don't have to do it. Like, not that this job is perfect by any means, but, like, to avoid that kind of sense of crunch or to have to play those games back to back to back to get the reviews out. Like, I think a lot of people, a lot of critics were talking about when Elden Ring dropped, and they were saying, how the hell can we give this game its due with the time frame that we've had to review it and then write the content? Because that takes absolutely ages in and of itself, never mind getting through a game as big as Elden Ring in a small time frame to do it justice. So I think hopefully that's kind of changing and those review windows are getting longer. But, you know, obviously that's not for every single
game. Think I would welcome a wider conversation with more industry experts on almost thermonuclear detonating the foundations of video game coverage, because they're born out of the film coverage model. They're born out of, like, the press gets access to it early, they get through it, and they have it ready to launch when the thing launches. It's almost like a tech review or a product thing. The time taken to review that thing is so much longer than a film or getting hands-on with a piece of kit or whatever it is, and the actual press cycle doesn't really reflect that.
Yeah.
Like, and obviously, different games, different lengths, like things like Elden Ring. I would have hated to do Elden Ring in a week.
That's
that
it, right?
That would have sucked.
And I think, you know, again, people might be listening and saying, what a 1% problem, but it, like, is. You don't play that game during work hours. Like, it's not like you can take the full week, play Elden Ring, do a bit of content on it. Like, you're doing 8 hours a day at work, and then you have the kind of real pressure of trying to get through that game then in your own time. And while you might have played it anyway, it's just a completely different mindset. And I don't want to, like, sound condescending, because if you haven't, like, had that experience, you kind of think, well, it's just playing a video game. It's just playing a game you want to play. What's the big deal, Josh? It sounds like an absolute dream.
Sometimes it's that. But it's... But no, it's still not during work hours.
Yeah, but it is a very different way of approaching that game, I find, anyway, than you would if it was your own time, even in the same sort of week, even if you were going to play 6 hours a night anyway. It's just a different mindset to be in, because you know it's for work.
Yeah, it totally is. I always wanted to do it. I mean, maybe we'll do this at some point, a separate podcast on the reality of reviews. People can ask us anything about reviews and everything else, because I've always found them to be the thing that is, it's an unnatural way to play through a game. Elden Ring, it takes like 6 or whatever years to produce and you crunch through it in a week. Like, it's just not a natural way to do it. I also, more subjectively, prefer playing through something with a community anyway, with, you know, checking in on social media, seeing people hit different points as they get through the story. Playing through something early is, it's fun, it's fine, but, like, you don't really gain much from it other than just doing it for the sake of having something live at the time, which increasingly is not worth it, because either there's too much competition or the outlet that you're working for, like us, isn't a review-based model. People like our opinions and they'll listen to the podcast and we'll put the lists out and they're opinionated. You'd hope so. But, you know, like, it's not, we don't need to turn stuff around that fast unless unless some companies will give you it early enough where it's actually feasible.
Totally, 100%.
But it's rare.
Tell me about when you weren't on a hype train for a game.
I think my last one was Sonic Frontiers. There was just such an innocence to that, because I was just like, man, I love Sonic. The Sonic 2 movie sort of revitalized a lot of just loving that character. And Sega played their cards really well. There was, like, the Netflix show, there was the movie, and there was running up to the Sonic Frontiers thing. It was open world. I managed to play it at EGX with Sai, and me and her had such a great time with it that we were just like, that was actually really good. Like, is it just me, or was that actually really good? And just getting so carried away with that thing. But like that was just an entirely, completely personal. It's fun to love Sonic for a bit.
Of course. When weren't you on one where like everyone else was really hyped for a game and you just had no idea?
Probably Resident Evil 4 remake or something.
Aww.
If it's no idea why, then it's something like Pikmin 4, because I've only just been playing Pikmin now. Right. I've never played Pikmin before and I'm loving Pikmin 4. But if it's something where I'm just like, I just don't care, it would be the Resident Evil 4 remake. Or just anything where it's like, hey, old thing, I just don't care. Like, if it depends what it is. If it was something that really touched me as a kid in the nice way, then maybe I'll want to go back to it to some degree, but it would need we talked about this loads before, but like the original team or a reason to exist, something other than just get that bank, which is the reality of knowing the industry, where it's like, I see what you guys are doing.
The last hype train that I was on was Final Fantasy 16, which overhyped the game too much for me and kind of burnt me a little bit and made
hype
me
is a
realize
bad
that.
Double-edged sword,
yeah,
man.
It kind of made me realize, oh, the days when I used to get super hyped for things, maybe they weren't as good as my rose-tinted glasses suggest, because with a lot of hype comes potentially a lot of disappointment. Yeah. And I wasn't hugely disappointed for Final Fantasy 16, but I did let my expectations run away with themselves a little bit for that game. Mm-hmm. But
I think if you build up a certain version of a game in your head and then you just want to play that thing that you've imagined,
yeah,
and it's not that, you will only be disappointed. I always find as a golden rule that you're better off going in completely open-minded with a neutral sort of like flat plane and then let the game impress you. You'll notice all the positives anyway.
That's why I've not been on many hype trains over the past few years, despite really being excited for the announcements of certain games, because like you were saying before, you know, I try my best if it's a game I know I'm going to play to not watch anything beforehand. So that almost means that I can't get too excited because I don't have anything to latch onto.
Yeah.
And I can manage to go into that actual release with like almost neutral opinions. Obviously, it won't be because I'm still looking forward to the game, but with no expectations of what the game is actually going to be, because I've not like latched onto a mechanic and I'm not wondering whether that's going to be integral to the whole experience or that's going to be the thing that it's defined on. And that's not like the best way to be. It's not the only way to be, but it's a way that I've found works for me.
Yeah, well, the thing is, like, thrown in here as well, I mean, I'll just be completely honest. Like, I it's one of those things where to get on a hype train, it needs to be something to be genuinely to your core, to your soul, hyped about. I can't wait to play that. I can't wait to see how that feels when I move it, to control it or whatever. There's not been anything like that, like, for me. Like Viewfinder, I kind of had that with its gimmick. Like, there's just very little. There's very little now in this age, especially in a certain tier of production, where you're going to see reused game mechanics, reused various design ideas, whether it be loot or different monetization practices or ways that you move through the world or whatever. There's very little that can wow in the same way that it could. And we were lucky enough to be young at the time.
Yeah.
So you could be wide-eyed at Metal Gear Solid 2's cutscenes and then be blown away by how many innovative things were in the gameplay.
Yes.
It just rarely lines up anymore. 9 times out of 10, you know what you're getting. And I just find that gets in the way of being able to be completely blindly hyped for something because you already know what it's going to be.
I agree with that. And I'll tell you why that feeds into something that I was very hyped for, the PSVR 2.
Right.
Because obviously in the run-up to launch for that bit of kit, you had the specs, you had some first impressions, but VR is a thing you inherently can't experience until you've experienced it. You can see an approximation of it, but you don't really know how it's going to play, how it's going to feel. So that was exciting because everyone, I think, kind of got on the hype train for the PSVR 2 who was interested in that release and kind of ended up imagining something that was almost in the realm of sci-fi.
Like a kid.
Myself included, like a kid. And I remember like the weeks and months leading up to the launch of that thing, being on the subreddit I wasn't talking to other people, but I was looking at the discussions that other people were having and really getting carried away. And I ultimately, thankfully, enjoyed that at the end, but it was dangerous because I did see a lot of people like myself who were really getting invested, really overhyping what it could deliver, and then getting it and thinking, okay, this is VR. It has these drawbacks that people weren't necessarily talking about initially. I wasn't really expecting that.
Just thinking of it, I'm like, hype is fundamentally subjective. It's your brain, it's your expectations, it's your past experiences with the IP, it's whatever, it's your gaming history, or maybe it's your first new title, but you're still thinking something ahead of time. It's subjective. You are then met with objective. The game, the thing you're interacting with can only be that one thing. It can't mold to you because it just can't. It's an existing thing. So when they meet, that's the clash. Like, I think you're better off trying to meet out that hype and just go in, you know, completely blank and let that thing you know, appear in front of you and then form your subjective opinions from the objectivity.
Yeah.
You're trying to mold the objective fact thing to your personal idea of what it should be.
The reason, well, one of the main reasons that I stopped watching film trailers was, one, because they continue to spoil the final shots in so many of them. But two, I would love them. I would love them as an art form. Mm. And for something like Spider-Man 3 back in the day, or The Force Awakens, I would watch over and over and over again.
Right.
To the point where I was already constructing the movie in my head. So then when I would watch the final film, and it wasn't, it didn't approximate the narrative that I'd already built in my head and the visuals that I'd already imagined in my head, I realized I was kind of marking these things down for not being the product that I imagined them to be. And I kind of realized that was just not a healthy way to engage with media. At least it wasn't for me, because, you know, it's never going to be the thing that you picture beforehand. It's always going to smash your expectations in one way or another.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon. If you've invested that much into something, and I realized I absolutely was, so right. I was like, I need to put a stop to that.
Oh, I'm all like that side of pre-release, anything goes, fan theory time, it can be anything, but it's the definitive article is the whatever you then see, whether it's a movie or an album or the game or whatever, but you have to accept that you're wrong. Like, I mean, not you necessarily, but that mindset, I definitely used to have that, because that's the double-edged side of the hype thing,
yeah,
where it's just, so you have to accept that you were wrong about something. Like Last of Us 2, a lot of people had that, and but I'm fine with that. I love being proven wrong. I love one of the best things that you can do is give me a trailer that misdirects me, still excites me, but then the thing that you have at the end is actually better than what you misdirected. It's very rare that someone does that, but the new Castlevania trailer for Castlevania Nocturne is like incredible because it barely gives you anything. And I think that's a really good way of teasing everything. And then it's like, okay, how do those fights, how do those clashes, how do those, what looks like various main characters being annoyed with each other, how does that line up? Like, for me, the reveal is far more satisfying than the fan theory side of it, but I love getting lost in the preview cycle as well.
Yeah, yeah,
it's true. Just that you have to be willing to give all of that up when you're actually in front of it. Okay, let's actually see what they've got.
Yeah.
Like, and give up the entire previous 5 months.
That's it. I guess because I was like well younger, you know, talking teenagers, late teens, maybe even early 20s when I was like kind of doing that and getting hyped for a movie that didn't really exist. It only existed in my mind.
Is always my other golden rule, which is just what were they going for? What did they nail?
Yeah.
If you have ideas of what they need to nail, that's just, for me, that's wrong. Like they're not appeasing you. They're doing their own thing.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I love that now. I almost am annoyed at how invested I got in Mass Effect 3's ending back in the day. You know, I was one of those people who was demanding them change it, demanding them add this and that. Uh-huh. And now I think, nah, man, if that's the story they want to tell, they're entitled for it to be bad. You know what I mean? Even if you don't like it necessarily, like that's the ending they went with, and you can criticize it all hell, and I definitely encourage that. But to demand they change it, to me, that was almost crossing the Sopranos line.
Yeah. That's like a weird sort of death of the author type thing where it's just sort of like, no, we deserve better and you will make it for us. Like the remaking Rise of Skywalker or whatever. I think they're bigger questions because in Mass Effect 3's case, like hardly any of the staff left at that point were that indebted to it. And then the more you read about it, the more it was just words sketched on a napkin that they had to put stuff together in the last minute. I forget where that interview was from. All that stuff is fascinating in terms of just like our relationship to media, especially with gaming. You're going to put 50, 60 hours into a thing. And then like, you know, is that a good time investment or not? And then trying to prepare for that as well.
That's it. I mean, just think about one game that you've been looking forward to. It doesn't even have to be a 50, 60 hour game. It could be 5 hours. Mm-hmm. It could be 8 hours. It's not just about the 8 hours you're playing that game, is it? It's about all of the hours you've invested in watching those previews, keeping up with its development, learning about who's coming on the project, and how it's shaping up one trailer compared to another. And then it's about playing the game. And then it's about all the conversations that come after, you know? Like, it has this legacy that precedes it and this legacy that follows it, that like kind of extends for potentially hundreds, if not thousands of hours beyond the actual product itself, which could be 1% of that investment time. Plus, I just think that's an interesting way to experience something.
Entirely, man. So much of a person, so much of us is invested in that run-up or invested in that thing. And if that's a letdown, then it's like that subconscious thing. Maybe I was wrong to invest in this. Like, oh, I hate this. Oh, this makes me feel bad or whatever it is. I always think that the most annoyed people in comment sections or the most annoyed people online, they're too overly personally invested in a thing and it's let them down or it's not what they thought it was or whatever. And they're all just manifestations of essentially a version of insecurity. Like, it's okay for that thing to suck. You're more important. You are worth more. You are worth more than whatever that thing is. It's fine for that thing to suck. Just let it go and go on to the next thing. Champion the stuff that you like or whatever. But that's a bigger conversation. a question from Juan Castaneda, who says, in respect of the SAG strike currently happening in America, what is the best written video game you've played? Not necessarily story-based, but where the dialogue/text kept you glued. Ooh. Also, favorite video game quote.
Solidarity to all striking workers, first of all.
Massively.
And second, for the the best written game in terms of dialogue and text.
The thing is, when he said, what is best, not necessarily story-based, my default is Disco Elysium.
Yes,
I think that's the best written recent thing I've been through in quite some time. I actually love the way Final Fantasy 16 is written. Not necessarily story-based, but I love the character writing. I love all the little affectations that they got from the actors improvising on the day. Apparently Square Enix encouraged the actors to just, you know, improvise various sort of colloquialisms or things that would make their characters feel like they were from different parts of the, obviously the UK in real life, but different parts of Balestier in the world, which led to Gav sounding like a genuine Geordie or saying various words that only people from the Northeast would understand or whatever. But I love there's a level of writing in Final Fantasy 16 that I personally find to be perfectly dry and just British, just such a, it's a rainy gray day, but we'll get on with it and we'll achieve things anyway and whatever. It's just sort of like there's just a quality there that I find very endearing. And it reminds me of my grandparents and it reminds me of my own childhood with my grandparents. And it's just, there's just something about that I really latched onto in Final Fantasy 16. And I found that, obviously there's some parts of the story that are kind of all over the place and whatever. I love the thing overall, but in terms of the vast majority of interactions you have, especially with someone like Karen or Blackthorn, they're just so, they've seen it all. They just don't care anymore. It's raining today, it'll rain again tomorrow. Let's just get through everything. And there's just something about that sort of hardiness that I love.
I know we talked about it a few UBPs ago with Sai about like the localization of Final Fantasy 16 script, like you were mentioning there. And I do love the specificity of it. And I know this is probably as much the voice actors coming in and bestowing those lines with a sense of authenticity as much as it is the writers. But I'll always love a moment in that game where I think it's... I think it might be Goots, who isn't necessarily a Geordie, but is from like nearby areas, is from closer to where I am. Like, sounds more Teesside, like Sunderland.
Looking after his nan.
County Durham, right? And there's a line in the script where he was supposed to say canny, which is more of a Geordie thing.
Oh.
But because he's from a few towns over, I noticed the voice actor changed it to can it. I can't do it, which is more authentic. And it was such a small change that might have got completely overlooked in a other big AAA game from someone who isn't from Britain. But the fact that they managed to get so granular with the language to that degree, because they could have had canny in there and people probably wouldn't have batted an eyelid. Like 99.9% of people wouldn't have noticed. Mm-hmm. But to change that to can it, I just thought that was incredible. I thought that was like an amazing bit of localization that like I just did not expect at all.
Yeah, and it's like if you go in Final Fantasy's case, like if you go back to like you know the 90s Final Fantasies and Final Fantasy overall has nearly always been so buttoned up with its production. They've hardly ever shown off the voice actors before. I don't think they've ever done that before. Showing you the making of everything, like checking in with everybody, checking in with Ben Starr as Clive or whoever, and like yeah, that's they've come so far and just going like it's okay to show this process and to let people have more input, like the voice actors in that particular context or whatever, which is really good. Do you have any favorite video game quotes?
Oh, can I quickly jump into
that? Or even the best written video game.
Can I quickly jump into that one?
Yes.
Just because earlier this week, I finally watched the NoClip documentary on the production of Immortality, which was absolutely incredible.
Shout out to NoClip overall, by the way. The amount of archival stuff they've just put online. I don't think they've disclosed how this happened, but I always get his name wrong, but it's Danny O'Dwyer.
Yes.
Danny Dyer is the actor.
Yes.
Danny O'Dwyer, who runs NoClip. They came into possession of various tapes from, I think it's GameSpot's archive. So they now have all the footage of like Sony's 2006 conference or whatever it is. And then they've gone through like an upscaler thing. So you can just watch old E3 conferences, everything. It's the channel's called NoClip Archive. And you can just watch gaming history in HD for the first time ever. And it's gorgeous. It's essential. Go get lost in that stuff.
It's a great channel. Great work, like you said. Always been amazing. But I just feel like they keep knocking it out of the park with all of these different documentaries and these projects, like that restoration thing that you just mentioned. But watching that documentary on Immortality, I already knew that was a well-written game, and it is kind of a cheat because it's a game about movies and you're watching live-action movies, so it's kind of not the same as game writing, but it's so ambitious because that, if you don't know it, is a title about three different movies from three different time periods, and you have the films themselves, and you have the backstory behind them. So you have behind the scenes clips that you're looking at, and you have press parties and you have rehearsals. So watching that documentary, I found out that initially they wrote three full movie scripts for each of the fake movies.
Okay.
Not all of that script was shot. They only shot the essential parts for the story they wanted to tell, and then had to give you enough so you kind of understood the broad strokes of each narrative, which I thought was impressive in and of itself. But on top of that, they're having to be period authentic. They're having to chart all of the different characters throughout all of their arcs. They're having to integrate the behind-the-scenes stuff, when to write a scene as it will be shown in the finished film, quote-unquote, or write a scene as it is rehearsed. And there is so many logistical nightmares to that that I couldn't help but find it impressive to write all of this material. I think it was like a 420 or 480 page shooting script.
That's insane.
And managed to thread it all together across this decade spanning narrative where everyone's playing two or three parts in a way that even makes sense, never mind is good, is shocking to me.
Immortality deserves a massive shout out regardless. Like, I enjoyed that game nowhere near as much as you did. I didn't get as fully invested in it as you did. But yeah, just the fact that you've got Sam Barlow, who, like, for me, was known for Her Story. I forget the one he did in between. It's the...
Telling Lies, I think.
Telling Lies. Like, he's sort of becoming known as sort of someone who is shooting, like, you know, live-action stuff and then gamifying various parts of it. And Her Story I absolutely loved as, like, a murder mystery thing. And Immortality has so much more going on. It's still on Game Pass if you want to go check it out. Would massively recommend that. Favorite game quote? quotes. It's the one that I grew up loving. It's just what comes to mind if someone asks me my favorite game quote. It's Gray Fox when he's about to die.
Nice.
In Metal Gear Solid 1, and he's under the foot of Metal Gear Rex, and Liquid says something like, oh, in the Middle East, we don't hunt foxes, we hunt jackals. And then Gray Fox is like, oh, is a cornered fox is more dangerous than a jackal, and he blows the radar off. Oh, God, I love hero moments so much.
I don't think I have a favorite quote, but the one that lives rent-free in my brain, in a very nice bit of synergy between us here, Scott Tilford, is unlimited ammo.
Everyone was doing that in high school at the time, just doing their pointing the thumb and just sort of like, oh, have you got a pencil? Oh, unlimited ammo, here's the thing. That was my entire year group was after Metal Gear Solid 2.
That's all I've got, I think. I can't think of anything else that comes to mind. I'll probably kick myself as soon as we stop recording when a great one does pop in that I love, but right now I'm going with unlimited ammo.
Go with Metal Gear. It's just the record scratching asterisks from Death Stranding. That's that's the subtitle quote. Question from Zach Nietzsche, who says, Star Wars Outlaws, were you guys hoping for a more expansive GTA-style world like some had assumed and that we were getting from the various wanted levels shown in the gameplay trailer, or do you think the recently clarified, very focused action-adventure RPG is actually the right move?
I think it's the right move, only because this is an Ubisoft game and they have tried so many times to hit that sprawling GTA-style sandbox.
Have they?
I would say so, with stuff like Watch Dogs and even stuff like Assassin's Creed. What I mean by that is a huge world to kind of lose yourself in, not necessarily the GTA structure.
I was trying to think of an Ubisoft crime sandbox. Yeah, Watch Dogs, that's almost a decade old now.
Yeah, but they keep trying with it, man. They do. Yeah, Watch Dogs 1, Watch Dogs 2, Watch Dogs Legion, and to see them kind of fail to live up to GTA caliber with that. I kind of want them to take a step back a little bit and deliver something more focused before they continue down the route that they are currently on. That's just my opinion,
though. I disagree. I just because, like, as we said this on one of the other many podcasts we did, that there's very few crime sandbox games out there. Like, GTA has the monopoly on it. No one else ever really tries. And the idea of doing the whole scoundrel Star Wars framing thing with whatever you can come up with for new, innovative, cool, wanted level mechanics could be fresh. That would be a way of immediately making Outlaws a distinct Star Wars game and a distinct Ubisoft game.
My issue is, I love what GTA does with its crime sandbox, but the key ingredient to me is the reactivity of its world. It's so fun to go crazy in their world because it just feels like something that exists. It feels like something that is lived in. It feels like a location first and a set of gameplay mechanics second almost. True. Whereas with Ubisoft open worlds, especially in Watch Dogs, they're so sterile and so artificial that I can't have fun in the same way that I do in a Rockstar game. And it is just in how gamified their worlds feel where they're a little bit empty. So while I'm sure you could have a lot of fun in Outlaws doing the Star Wars crime thing in this underworld, I'm sure that would be fun for a bit. I don't trust Ubisoft at this moment in time to deliver a world reactive enough and believable enough to give those kind of mechanics that deeper level to them.
Yeah, I back that. I think from where they are right now, no, I don't buy them. I don't believe Ubisoft's going to do much of anything at a top tier thing until they prove it again. I'm kind of curious about Assassin's Creed Mirage in that respect, because they've doubled down on the big IPs. They've got like 15 Assassin's Creed games in the works. They sort of announced the Star Wars stuff, but the proof's definitely in the pudding with them. They've had such a spotty track record.
Assassin's Creed is an interesting one, I think, because you look at the early games, especially Assassin's Creed 1 and 2, and I don't know how you feel about this, but those worlds did feel like a Rockstar world in terms of the reactivity, in terms of the detail.
Assassin's Creed 1, the best one?
Well, but like Assassin's Creed 1, when you're like, how fun was it to just walk around in those streets? You know what I mean? Blend into the crowds, move past them. That level of detail to the animations, that level of authenticity to this fictional world that they had created was so believable. And I found that you lost that as the Assassin's Creed series wore on and it got bigger, to the point where something like Valhalla in Odyssey is so gamified, I almost don't take any of it seriously. Mm-hmm. And I don't stop to kind of look at things. I don't believe that I'm in a real world. I believe that I'm in a video game simulation, because there's huge swaths of land that you just run through and you're not supposed to even stop and look at. You never look back, really, in those games. You're constantly pushing forward. It all feels like set dressing when, for me, it should be the key ingredient.
Yeah, that's true. And plus, like, in the newer ones, like Origins, Odyssey and Valhalla, they flag all the crafting components, big logos on screen, go pick this up, go get 10 of these, filling the HUD with different side quests and everything else. That's a really good point. Like, they had the sort of micro-open world approach with the original Assassin's Creed, maybe because of tech limitations at the time. But I feel like that's a way to go. If Dead Island 2 proved anything, it was refocused, you know, make it smaller, still keep it open world as an overall thing, but make the environment smaller and more focused and detailed.
That's a great example, I think. Bosh. So yeah, I think, you know, I'd love to see Outlaws be this GTA-inspired crime sandbox, but only if they could nail the sandbox part of that. And modern Ubisoft games, for me anyway, don't give me much hope that they could.
I would agree. Question from Frajakat, who says, when's the next GTA quiz? I love how competitive Scott gets in them. LMFAO. I'm putting this in here because we have a couple of quizzes, or three quizzes, on the immediate horizon. Anyone listening to this will get first dibs on what they're going to be. We have a Spider-Man quiz coming, a Batman Arkham quiz coming, and a recent modern recent gaming history quiz as well. I forget what the actual title of that one is, but they're all in production. We've shot them all, and they'll be out at some point.
And you are incredibly competitive in them all, if I recall.
Yeah, I don't know. Right now, because they're not live, I did really well. I won all of them. Yeah. But we'll see how they go.
I, unsurprisingly, spoilers, bottled every single one, like I always do.
No.
Crack under pressure.
You will have to keep an eye on the YouTube channel for them. I don't know if the audio will be going out for them as well. We'll see how well they work on audio forms, but they should be out in the next few weeks. The Spider-Man one's almost done, far as I know. We got very lucky because the Spider-Man 2 trailer just randomly dropped.
Oh, that's the one I'm not in, but I'll love to watch it.
The little face will just put it in the corner. Question from Patrick, who says, will Clive's mother from Final Fantasy 16 be added to a top 10 most hated villains list anytime soon?
She might be, you know.
She might be. Annabelle, most pristine POS in that game.
She was, I love its commitment to showing her as a bad egg from scene one, and then never subverting it, just going, no, she's
a full-on villain.
Yeah.
Nothing redeemable.
She's the villain of this piece.
Yeah.
Speaking of mothers in Final Fantasy 16, though, Scott Tilford, what is going on with Barnabas's mother in that game? Like, what's the story behind?
Well, we'd have to get into spoilers with that stuff.
Oh, is that right?
If you mean the scene, I think you mean.
Well, I just mean that she's referenced a few times, but I feel like she's, well, for me, the backstory wasn't delved into. The game's got a weird thing about mothers, is all
it does
I'm trying
a bit.
To say.
There's all the like rumors doing the rounds. I guess it's not really rumors anymore because Yoshi P. Naoki Yoshida has said they want to do more with it now. So it seems like they are going to do DLC, even though they initially said they weren't going to. And I've seen quite a lot of people over on Twitter, not X or whatever you call it.
Oh, yes.
Over on Twitter showing the, and it's very easy to see, and I noticed this as well, maybe you did. When you're exploring it's the northern regions of Rosaria, you can see another mother crystal over the ocean. There's another one sticking out of one of the islands. And the story just never addresses it. The story is about getting rid of the mother crystals, and there's one right there. We just never get rid of it. And so there was always assumptions that something else should have happened with that. And people have gone back through earlier versions of the game when it was being demoed to notice that there was originally a tower, not where that crystal was, but just north of Phoenix Gate, which is where you sort of start the game. There was a tower visible in one of the early game demos that's not on the world map in the finished version. Now, evil towers are a thing in Final Fantasy. There's a one in Final Fantasy 4, there's one in Final Fantasy 6. This idea of like a final gauntlet as you sort of go up this tower or find something specific from it, maybe that's what the DLC is going to be, and maybe we'll figure out what the last Mother Crystal is. I mention all this because it's not really spoilers, but lore stuff, there's an old cult mentioned in Final Fantasy 16 called the Circle of Malleus.
Okay.
A lot of assumptions about Barnabas are linked to that cult and are also linked to his mother's involvement in that cult.
Right.
So maybe it's all one thing.
No spoilers if you can, but do you think Clive's mother will go down as the most villainous character in that game? Or if not most villainous, one of the best villains in that game? Or do you think that crown is held by others?
I think the crown's definitely held by others. I think Annabelle's extremely effective. I just wish there was more of her.
Me too.
Like courtroom scenes that you have with Prince Dion and her and everything else. They're great, and she gets there's a very early Game of Thrones Cersei energy going on with Annabelle, which is, I think it's really, really effective. But all the stuff that happens with Olivier and the stuff that with Dion and his dad and everything, I think that ends up taking more center stage because of what happens anyway.
Yeah,
overall, she needed to have more agency for it to be up there.
I would agree. I think generally, though, that Final Fantasy 16 has given us enough boss related materials to last another few years at least. So I'm at least thankful it delivered on that front, you know?
I agree. Next question from Rhino, who says, what are your thoughts on Ultimate Editions of games giving a few days early access to the game? Recently, it had me with Remnant 2, and I feel like it messes with the hype/news cycle alongside community discoveries.
Hate it.
Same.
Because for me, it's the only thing I would ever pre-order a game for. Because these video game publishers understand that hype is real, as we have mentioned previously on this podcast, that people want to play these games as soon as possible. And I think them throwing the early access card out there for these expensive editions is appealing to our, like, biggest natures as video game fans, and I hate that they can exploit that so easily, because I've never done it myself, but I'm always tempted by it.
It's always I've not done it myself, I don't think, off the top of my head. Mostly because we talked about this before about knowing the industry, you're just going to get a worse version of that game. If 9 out of 10 games can't nail their day one stuff anyway, let alone playing it days earlier, where the dev team's cut off even more from bug testing or application of patches and everything, it's just, you're just getting a worse version for more money. And it's like, it's £10, it's £20 in the UK for a day or 2 days early or whatever it is. So it's very rare that I'd need to get my hands on it that early. Unless it's a really trusted developer, but then they wouldn't be doing it. Like, Naughty Dog's not going to do it.
Yeah.
At least in theory. Sony's in a bit of a money grubby mood at the minute. So,
like,
maybe.
Sometimes I don't think it's like an inherently evil move, like some pre-order bonuses, I think, absolutely are. Yeah. Like, if they're just giving people the option to play the game earlier in some cases. But mostly, I don't get it, because sometimes it's the full game and sometimes it's part of the game. Mm. I think they mentioned, you know, Call of Duty does it, where you get the campaign a few days early, even a full week early. And I just think, why? Does that mean the campaign is sought after, or does it mean it's more disposable and can be chopped off the final product? I find that a weird practice, because I can't wrap my brain around it. If I want a Call of Duty game, I want every part of it. I don't just want to play the campaign, you know?
And
if I only wanted the campaign, give me the option to just buy the campaign. Don't make me pay more to access that early. That's the weird bit.
Yeah, for me, it's just the industry reality of, like, well, does that mean that the dev team, like, are they sacrificing part of what they need in regards to the last few days of development, which are crucial, like the last sort of few weeks or months of development are crucial, just so you can wring a little bit more out of the fandom? It's hard to look on it as a positive thing, because if the game was ready, then the whole thing would be available early. It's only a monetary gain.
I think, like you said as well, the fact that it's another way for publishers to charge people more for the worst version of the game, because, you know, it might not have the patches ready. It might just be plain old buggy like a Cyberpunk, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the element of it where I just think you guys want the most people to buy into the most expensive versions of your games as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And in their eyes, I think, to also defend those games, you know, before anyone else has got it, spread word of mouth, which doesn't have to be insidious, but I find sometimes the way it's implemented is just a little bit insidious.
This is a whole other thing, but it's like that whole thing of, like, you get a game out there that's broken, maybe it's in early access and it's broken, and then you have a wave of people who got it. Well, they've said they'll fix it, so it's fine. It's like, no. They still charged you for the broken thing. You're meant to be annoyed about that. You should be, you know, like, only paying for things, products that are actually going to work. Question from Honest NPC, who says, hello, awesome dudes, hope you're all well. Not a question as much, but just a rant that instead of being excited to buy a game I was anticipating on launch day, I'm waiting for a Digital Foundry deep dive to see performance instead. Has this stopped you from day one purchases?
So true.
It hasn't stopped me from day one purchases, but I do find, and I despise it, how much, and not Digital Foundry because they're phenomenal at it, but how much I have to do a check. Does it actually work? Check. Especially on a Switch game. I always have to do some little roundup of Google, some little roundup of random websites, Digital Foundry, whatever it is, just to see if the thing I'm about to buy actually works. And I hate it.
It broke my heart that Game of the Year, Resident Evil 4, I was so looking forward to it. I thought it was going to be pristine because, for me anyway, you know, Resident Evil 2 was pristine. Even Resident Evil 3, which I didn't necessarily like as a game, visually and from a presentation standpoint, was pristine. So I assumed Resi 4 would be, especially on next-gen consoles. So to buy into that title and then watch the Digital Foundry breakdown and realize it had a bunch of problems, I just thought, we are in a weird era of gaming right now. I mean, I almost didn't buy Jedi Survivor because I watched the Digital Foundry breakdown and realized how broken that thing was. It was only an immense sense of FOMO that made me jump into that game. And thankfully, I had a better experience. But there's a reality where I jump in, have a terrible time, kind of like you did, and then regret it. So Digital Foundry, I mean, like you said, are incredible. Like, the work they put out is amazing. Their breakdowns are becoming essential to helping you decide what to purchase. So yeah, I've definitely had an experience where I've been excited for a game, and rather than, because I don't really look at reviews or review scores, rather than hoping a game scores a 9, I'm hoping it gets a good Digital Foundry tech breakdown.
That's the thing,
that's
like,
what I'm more interested
there
in.
There needs to be, and there are various websites that kind of track this stuff, but not that well in terms of, you know, what frame rate is it running at, what resolution is it running at, when was the last time someone actually sat down and played it, what version of the patch are they using? Like, I would love it if you went on the store pages on Nintendo, Xbox, Sony, whatever, and there was just a little box that said last played, blah, this is the current performance. So you can just keep on top of it, so you know what you're buying. You so rarely in gaming know what you're buying. It's the most simplistic thing to do from a consumer marketing standpoint, and they just can't give you a specific thing.
Nah.
They would rather hook, line, and sinker or whatever and get more money out of you.
I think what's interesting, right, is so many times when we have got a game early and we're embargoed, so we can't talk about it. You know, I like going on the subreddits and seeing what people are saying about
going
it.
Going like, I know that thing.
Yeah, like, how I wish I could go? Type. I wish I could type the answer to this. But so many times I've seen, and this obviously isn't the majority of players, but I have noticed it's a lot of players who, when reviewers will come out with reviews and they talk about the bugs, so many of them kind of say, well, they reviewed it. It's without the day one patch.
Right.
And so many times we review something with the day one patch, and like, we just can't say it sometimes because it's not fully out. So you'll get a bunch of like warning posts on Reddit saying, like, take these reviews with a grain of salt. Like, they're not playing the version we're going to play. And that's the one where I see the comment and I want to type like, we are playing the game. Like, please believe us when we talk about these bugs. They're not magically going to disappear. And to me, that kind of links into the previous question about buying into a game early, because I think that kind of, it's not disinformation, but it's certainly a little bit of chaos about what the final launch version is going to be. I think only helps publishers because they can say, well, this might not be the version you're going to play, or might be a little bit better magically.
Yeah, I think at the flip side of that is the assumption that everything will be fixed. So it's like, how much do you factor that into the review? And like, there are some times in reviews where someone said, I just couldn't finish this. I forget which game it was on IGN where the reviewer said, I just couldn't finish this game. It was too broken. And then there was a whole thing about, should you have still classed it as a review or whatever? And sometimes there's an assumption that things will get fixed, and then bugs and glitches, easily patchable things, are then overlooked. But then when they're not actually sorted, like in Jedi Survivor's performance mode, they are a humongous, immediate part of why that game on that mode sucks. So it's just like one of those things where like, there's an assumption that is then taken advantage of in various different ways. That sucks. Final question from Kieran Moore, who says, following on from my previous Sunday roast or cheesy beans on toast question, if you were stuck on a desert island and could only take one British delicacy with you, what would you take and why?
I fooled myself here. Good feeling. I want to go Greg's sausage roll.
I was going to go Greg's as well.
But I know myself enough
chicken bake
to know that if I eat too many Greg's sausage rolls, I'll feel sick. So I couldn't have them forever. But that would be the immediate British delicacy that I would want. But if I had to eat it every day, I would be sick.
Sunday roast, I mean, a Sunday roast, you have to have a specific component for it to be an individual delicacy, I'd imagine.
Yes.
I would take one Yorkshire pudding.
Oh.
If I'm siphoning, what's the best part of the roast? It's probably the Yorkshire pudding.
Can I tell you?
Go on.
Can I strap you in and discuss my history with the... Can I shock you?
Yeah.
Can I talk about my Sunday roast history?
Yeah.
I was a really picky eater as a kid, and I wouldn't eat anything.
Surprises me.
So, I know, I can imagine that, right? So my Sunday roast for like 10 years of my life was peas, carrots, mashed potato, and Yorkshire puddings.
That's it.
No gravy.
No meat.
No meat.
What?
No gravy, no meat.
Why?
So to offset the lack of sustenance on my plate, I would make up for it in the amount of Yorkshire puddings I would eat. So every week I would have between 12 and 24 Yorkshire puddings, right?
Oh my God.
In this kind of, I know, right? I was like a Yorkshire pudding fiend, like an absolute, like if there was ever a shortage in the late 2000s of Yorkshire puddings, I'm the reason why, because they were all going in my
belly.
That's
insane.
But the older I got and the more I tried food, like the bigger my Sunday roast plate got, so I added in, you know, I added in broccoli, cauliflower.
You actually had a roast.
I actually had a roast. Yeah. Eventually, as of about 3 years ago, I even started eating gravy on it, Scott Telford. I finally completed the roast.
3 years ago!
But the issue is, I still loved Yorkshire puddings so much that the volume of Yorkshire puddings eaten around the roast would never waver. So I started having a regular roast alongside all of these Yorkshire puddings.
Right.
And it was just too much. All of this to say, my love for the Yorkshire pud is undying.
I adore Yorkshire puddings. I think you've got the right answer there. Thank you. Do you have a particular Yorkshire pudding brand that we should shout out? We're not sponsored by anybody ever, but Aunt Bessie's.
My mum's.
If she becomes a full brown band, then yeah.
I'm always a homemade Yorkshire pudding guy, but Aunt Bessie's, you can't go wrong with.
True.
And recently, you know, since I got a bit more bougie, fan of the beef dripping Yorkshire puddings.
Really great.
You don't get enough of them, though.
Those big ones that Co-op do them. This is just an old man podcast now, the big Co-op ones are very good. You get four in a packet,
Here's the thing. Don't like the big Yorkie. You know when people put a Sunday roast inside of the Yorkshire
pudding? Oh, not an entire
pudding?
Dinner plate one.
No. Like, big ones, but as long as they're still of a, if we're categorizing them, there would be small ones, they're just the bigger versions of them. Never a big one. The quality's not there.
I remember when I was a tiny child and I didn't understand how to eat them because I was like, well, I can't, am I supposed to cut this? I used to just pick the whole thing up. I used to scoop my food in and pick it up like a sort of like a vol-au-vent.
I wish I could say I used to do that. I still do that right now. Because I never had gravy, that was never a problem.
I can't believe this.
I could just pick the Yorkshire puddings up and eat them. Right. And oh man, my favorite thing to do. Right now, get a Yorkshire pudding, right? Get one of those nice, fancy Yorkshire puddings, bougie Yorkshire puddings, right? A little bit of gravy, a little bit of mashed potato in the center, a little bit of whatever meat you have, make a little wrap, a few peas in there as well. It drips all over you, but oh, I would take that. I would take that.
Make it into a cigar, like a Yorkshire pudding cigar. I need to look at the global distribution of the listeners because I know that most of our audience is in America and they have no idea what we've just said for the last 10 minutes. But well, the people who will, have a lovely time.
I have a question to those viewers and to those listeners, actually, if I may end on this.
You may.
Genuinely, one, do you have what we would class as a Sunday roast? Mm. Two.
Or just a Sunday dinner.
Oh, a Sunday dinner. Two, do you have Yorkshire puddings? Do you know what that is? Do you have any of them at all? And three, I know your gravy is actually our tomato sauce. You know what we have on pasta? They refer to, well, at least some in some states and some
It tends to be more like a casserole thing, like in America where it's like biscuits and gravy. That's like, we would call it mince and dumplings.
Right. Yeah. Well, all I know is from The Sopranos where they refer to gravy as like the tomato sauce you put on pasta.
That's madness.
Aye, ours is not that, is it?
No.
So those are my questions. Okay. What is your gravy? Would you eat our gravy? Do you have a Yorkshire pudding? What's a Sunday roast?
Yeah, I want to know
please
what people's Sunday,
genuinely let me know.
Sunday meals are, or some sort of like weekly meal that is there that is checked in on. Because English thing, it's very much a roast dinner.
Yeah, what do Americans eat?
I don't know. the nearest thing they have is a Thanksgiving meal is what we have every Sunday, essentially.
Yeah.
And then the Christmas is like the nearest thing. We have a little mini Christmas every Sunday, essentially. It's pretty much what a roast dinner is.
That is true.
Pretty much. It's
do
like
they
the
have sausage rolls? Do you know what a sausage roll is?
I don't think so, because there was that thing that Greg's did where they opened a Greg's in Times Square. And then they were showing people pasties and sausage rolls and whatever.
The only reference point I have, did you ever watch, the Lad Bible Snack Wars, where they get celebrities on, like Ryan Gosling?
It rings a bell.
Well, they get celebrities on and they give them British delicacies, like we've been talking about, oftentimes a Greg's sausage roll. Uh-huh. And then they'll give them the delicacies from their hometown. So for Ryan Gosling, it was like a bunch of Canada stuff.
Right.
And they would face them off. Like, you would have a bite of this, you'd have a bite of that.
You'd have to
say what would win. And I always find that interesting because, one, I like seeing people eat sausage rolls for the first time. Uh-huh. But two, I'm always disappointed because they always give them cold ones. And that's not a way to experience it.
Should we go get some sausage rolls?
I'm absolutely stoked. We might.
This has been the Entitled Battle Podcast, the EVP, the UBP, the UBP. I've been Scott Telford. That's been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Telford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you, and we'll catch you next week. Have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
Welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.